This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. It's now a week and a day since an underwater earthquake shook the Indonesian island of Sumatra and sent tsunamis across the Indian Ocean. As bodies continue to wash ashore and remote areas are reached, the number killed is now over 150,000. Half a million people may have been injured. Something like 5 million are in urgent need. Food, water, fuel, medicine are being rushed to the region. Given the nature of the disaster, distribution of those supplies is inevitably better in some places than others. In the longer term, money and equipment will be needed to rebuild everything. Fishing boats, piers, villages, resort hotels, you name it. Governments around the world have pledged upwards of $2 billion. Japan leads the way with $500 million. The United States has pledged $350 million. Later in the program, we'll ask how firm those numbers are, how aid is sometimes switched or spent on the military. But thus far, individuals and private groups have pledged more than their governments. We'll also find out how that money is being spent, and we'll find out what's known about aid for the remote Andaman Islands. Some people there reject all contact with the outside world. If you have questions about how money is being raised and spent, about difficulties with distribution, our number here in Washington is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. The email address is totn@npr.org. And joining us now from Jakarta, Indonesia, is Ken Moritsugu. He's correspondent for Knight Ridder and joins us by phone from his hotel in Jakarta. We know it's quite late there. We thank you for staying up to speak with us.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be with you today.
Much of the aid for tsunami victims in Indonesia is being funneled through the capital, Jakarta. How are efforts moving along?
Well, they're moving along very slowly. They're slowly getting better. But there's still a big pileup of aid at the there's a military airbase just in the outskirts of Jakarta, and there are huge piles of boxes of food and clothing and so forth. They got 9 flights out of that airbase today up to Banda Aceh. Another 4 flights had to be scrapped simply because there wasn't room up there for the planes to get through and to land.
It sounds like things are getting backed up because, logistics are limited and a lot of aid is coming in.
Exactly, and that's a very good point. There's been a tremendous outpouring of aid, both from the international community and from Indonesians themselves. There's an airport next to the airbase where they're also collecting aid, and there are just boxes and boxes of instant noodles, of soap, of glasses, drinking water, everything you can think of, and sacks of clothing stuffed into old rice bags that Indonesians use. And that's all piling up. And so, yeah, while there is a logistic problem with getting all this, part of it, the issue is there is such a volume of aid that it's hard to get up there.
Who's in charge of collecting it all and organizing it and putting it on aircraft and getting it out?
Well, the collection is being done at centers that were set up all around the city of Jakarta, and they were set up by various groups such as the employees of the airport. They've become somewhat coordinated by the government, but the collection is somewhat done independently and is a little bit disorganized in that sense. The movement of the cargo up to Banda Aceh is being done by the military, coordinated by the Indonesian military, with assistance from the Australians as well as the U.S. and some other nations that are contributing planes and so forth.
As you look towards Banda Aceh is the capital of Aceh province, which has been, of course, in the middle of a long-running civil war as well, a separatist effort underway there. How has all of that played into the effort to rush supplies to a region war-torn and now tsunami-torn as well?
Well, I think initially there was some concern on the government's part because of the rebel movement up there, but the rebels agreed fairly early on to a ceasefire, and there was in fact a story in the local newspaper today about ex-rebels working with their former enemies, the army, helping to cart bodies out of the jungle. So I think everybody has really pulled together on this one. And there's, some hope that maybe this will lead to some goodwill that could actually lead to some progress in resolving that situation.
I understand you've also seen some refugees from some of the harder hit areas coming in on boats to Jakarta.
It wasn't on boats. They were coming back on the transport planes that took the aid up to Banda Aceh. And there are people who either have injuries or are otherwise ill and need immediate hospitalization, or else people who have relatives elsewhere in the country and want to resettle. When they come back, I talked to a few of them today, and there was a great sense of relief at being away from Banda Aceh. And whether they know Jakarta or not, one young 19-year-old woman who, you know, was studying to be a midwife and had spent all her life in Aceh, and she just said, "I'm so happy to be here." And when I asked her if she would ever want to go back to Banda Aceh, she just shook her head and didn't say anything more. Of course, that could change over time, but that's sort of the instantaneous reaction to this event and the opportunity to be able to get away from it.
Indonesia is a huge and diverse country. What kind of shock has this disaster had on the country, do you think?
Well, that's hard to say. I mean, I think, like, as with September 11th in the U.S., it certainly brought a lot of the country together in a way, and a lot of people have put aside whatever differences they may have had. Now may seem very petty in comparison to this event. And again, when you go back to those huge piles of clothes and food that have been donated by individuals, by companies, by members of the government, you know, there's a real outpouring of empathy for the people of Aceh. From my perspective, it looks like it's, at least in the initial week, people are, as I said, setting aside any differences and really focusing on let's help these poor people.
Ken Moritsugu, thank you very much again for staying up to speak with us. We appreciate it.
Thank you.
Ken Moritsugu is a correspondent for Knight Ridder and joined us by phone from his hotel in Jakarta, the capital of Indonesia. Joining our conversation now is Mary McClymont, president and CEO of InterAction, an umbrella group of more than 160 international development and humanitarian non-governmental organizations. These organizations operate in every developing country in the world, including those affected by last week's tsunami. She joins us by phone from her office here in Washington, and good of you to speak with us as well.
Thank you, Neil.
This morning, President Bush announced an ambitious new fundraising effort to be headed by former Presidents Clinton and Bush Sr. What's your reaction to this plan?
Well, we commend the president for his leadership. I think this is a wonderful step. We're grateful for it, to bring the stature of these two former presidents to this important phenomenon, and we really appreciate their willingness to respond and work with not only the American public, but really with other nations in confronting this terrible tragedy.
Now, they're going to be trying to encourage people to private people to donate money to organizations, I suspect, like your own.
Mm-hmm.
There's also governmental pledges. The U.S. has promised $350 million. How is that going to be spent?
Well, I think time will tell, but I would imagine, Neil, that it will go for assisting various UN agencies that are involved in the crisis, the National Red Cross and Red Crescent societies that are involved, certainly the American international NGOs that are involved, which are undertaking major relief efforts even as we speak and will need funding, of course, going forward for the rehabilitation phase as well. We've yet to see the details of that, but one thing I would want to mention is that that $350 million is exceedingly welcome. Unfortunately, the president had to draw down funding from our current disaster assistance accounts in the budget, which means to say that they're pretty much depleted for next year for all the other crises around the world. So we're going to want to urge the Congress to step up the plate and restore those funds as soon as possible.
If you'd like to join the conversation, by the way, our phone number is 800-989-8255. You can send email to totn@npr.org. And let's hear from Craig, who's with us from Phoenix, Arizona.
Yes, hi. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
My question, I guess, really follows on from what your previous guest was just saying, but really it's regards to how is that $350 million calculated? For example, the U.S. is having six frigates to help provide fresh water. Is the cost of running those frigates included in that $350 million?
And an aircraft carrier as well.
Yes.
Mary McClymont, go ahead.
Yeah, sure, Neil. And to the caller, again, as I say, we don't know the exact breakdown. I would imagine, indeed, that those incredible military assets that are being brought to bear, that are bringing in these ships and Marines to assist in all this critical equipment that will be needed for this operation, that's probably, but I don't know, outside of the $350 million, it may be a part of it. It's something we just don't know yet.
Is it typical for military expenditures like that, expenditures above and beyond whatever things were budgeted for, to be included in pledges like that historically?
Well, sometimes it happens that the military assets are brought to bear in these major natural disasters. It is only, you know, often the military that has the kinds of equipment that are needed that can help rebuild some of the infrastructure. And then it is the international non-governmental organizations and the United Nations agencies that really come to the plate and really distribute those goods and make sure that they work with the local communities to start helping rebuild the societies.
Mm-hmm. Craig, thanks
very much.
Bye-bye.
I appreciate your answer.
And also, you have to understand, and Mary McClymont, you know more about this than I do, but the military's heavy lift capabilities, all those helicopters on those marine aircraft carriers, those provide capabilities that are no one else in the region has that.
Well, I think that's probably true, and certainly the U.S. military is there. There, even as we know right now, that the group of ships with the Abraham Lincoln are already there, and another group of battleships are moving in. They will be there in the next several days. So you're right; these are critical logistical support assets that really are desperately needed in a crisis like this.
Okay, hang on the line with us, Mary McClymont. We're going to take a short break, and when we come back, we'll take more of your calls and emails on the question of aid to victims of the Indian Ocean tsunamis. Our phone number, 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. The email address is totn@npr.org. I'm Neil Conan. It's Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. We're talking about how aid reaches those hit by the earthquake and tsunami in the Indian Ocean area. Of course, you're invited to join the conversation if you have questions about how the money is being raised and spent, about difficulties with distribution, or about what you can do. Give us a call, 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. The email address is totn@npr.org. Our guest is Mary McClymont, the CEO of Interaction, and she's with us on the phone from her office here in Washington, D.C. And let's get another caller on the line. This is Adam, who joins us from Minneapolis.
Hello.
Hi.
Hi. I have a question about getting aid money, donating to legitimate groups. I donated to the International Red Cross online by following a link in a New York Times online article. And there were dozens and dozens of aid organizations listed, and I chose that because I recognized the name. But I understand there might be just scam artists operating who set up bogus group names and are just pocketing money that people are generously donating to people who need it. So how can we know which is which? Thank you.
Thanks for the call, Adam.
Sure. Well, you raise a very good point. I mean, unfortunately, there are groups who really try to take advantage of these sorts of situations, and it is appalling. But I would want to say a couple of things. I would welcome the caller and anybody else who would like to generously give to this to go to our website. It's www.interaction.org. And what you will find there is a list of almost 60 American relief nonprofit organizations that are working on this crisis. Maybe you'll recognize names you know, and you can contribute to those groups. Maybe if you don't know groups, you will be able to read about them and read about what they're doing. If you want to give to a children's group, you can do that. If you want to give particularly support for medical care, you can do that because you're able to see what the different organizations are doing. These organizations agree to conform with a set of standards that we have in place at Interaction on performance, on management, on fundraising, so that a contributor is able to know how his cash is actually being spent. So I would really commend people to go to these reliable groups that are known. It's something that President Bush, I'm grateful to say, said in his statement today, that it's important to give to groups that are reliable and that are already working on the tsunami crisis.
And we heard an interesting word from the caller, the Internet, donations pouring in over the web.
Yes, they are. It seems to be unprecedented at this point. We get anecdotes from our member organizations getting pledges of support greater than really any they've seen in this brief period of time after a major crisis. So it's really a generous outpouring of support for this effort.
Let's get another caller on the line. Sydney's with us from Jacksonville, Florida.
Tom, how are we doing?
All right, Sydney, you're on the air. Go ahead.
Yeah, my question was a simple one. Is you know, this $300 million that we've pledged, where is it coming from? I mean, in the sense that I know she said it came from the relief fund, but isn't that just something that us, the taxpayers, just going to have to, you know, bail back, you know, put the money back in, number one? And number two is, with all our issues here in the state and how we're in such a large budget deficit, why bother spending so much money? I mean, sending so much money. I mean, where does it benefit us?
Well, to the caller, basically the $350 million, it's not exactly clear what it is being drawn down from the various existing accounts, but it is clear that the money is being taken and will need to be replenished if the American people want to provide support, and I'm sure they do, to other disasters around the world. There's so many problems that we see where we can reach out and help people. Why should we do this? I think it's a great opportunity for Americans and the American government to be able to show our support to other nations, to show our goodwill. It's something that will make us safer at home. It'll make the world safer. It'll make it better. It's really not only the right thing to do for people, but I think it's the smart thing to do. And this is a great opportunity for us to actually help people who are truly in need. We see the pictures on the TV set. But also to, frankly, show our goodwill to the rest of the world as well.
Okay.
Sydney, thanks for the call.
Thank you.
We'll turn now to distribution, how this money spent on the ground to help the tsunami victims. To answer this question, we turn to Gail Newdorf, Deputy Director of the Emergency Unit for CARE USA. She's with us by phone from her office in Atlanta, Georgia, and welcome to you.
Thank you.
How does CARE decide where to spend its money?
Well, we definitely do it through a number of steps. First of all, we do an assessment. At the same time as we're actually responding, we're actually looking at the other types of needs that are out there. How many people are affected, what other organizations are doing, where are the people that are hardest hit, where are those communities that need the most back from us. And then based on that, we start looking at how best to allocate the monies and other resources we have to ensure the best coverage, and that doesn't duplicate with other agencies and organizations and what they are trying to do as well.
Non-duplication. Obviously, with aid so desperately needed, you'd hate for any of it to be wasted.
Exactly.
Once it's in the country, how are decisions made?
Well, we have a country director and an emergency operational team, and they work together with our CARE International emergency group, looking at how these the various options that are out there and what kinds of donors are going to be supporting us. And they are making the very day-by-day decisions. For example, on the day that this event occurred, our country directors were saying, here's cash, go out and buy whatever you can in the market and distribute it to people. That's the kind of immediate response that they can make. And now in these second terms, we step back a little bit and say, let's make sure that the rehabilitation is done thoughtfully, make sure that we're improving people's structures and infrastructure, their economic resources, rather than just replacing what they had before. Let's make it better for them.
Mary McClymont, before we let you go, I did want to ask, is CARE among the organizations that is on your website?
Yes, they are. They're very prominent and excellent member of the Interaction Alliance.
In general, do you monitor how much this money is, how this money is spent, and whether it's spent for immediate aid or for longer-term relief?
Yes, we'll get a general picture as the crisis unfolds. We'll get a much better sense of how the money is being spent and so forth in terms of the bigger picture. Each of the individual organizations will obviously monitor how much is being spent and where, and as will the U.S. government if it provides grants. But we will have a much clearer picture of the whole distribution as the crisis unfolds.
And Gail Newdorf, let me reverse that question and ask you, what's the role from your point of view of organizations like Interaction?
Well, they're definitely there to help bring together many of our advocacy issues. When we want to go to the American government particularly, they're very, very helpful in bringing us all together. They're there to coordinate some of the press messages that are going on as well, again, ensuring consistency. And they're there to ensure that those standards, as Mary mentioned earlier, are maintained and all of us are meeting the requirements of Interaction as an organization. So they play a very important role in bringing us all together and on the same page.
Well, Mary McClymont, we know you're very busy and we're going to let you go, but thank you very much for your time.
Thank you, Neil.
Mary McClymont, President and CEO of Interaction, joined us by phone from her office here in Washington, D.C. And let's continue with Gail Newdorf and continue taking questions from listeners. Again, if you'd like to join us, the number is 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK, the email address totn@npr.org. What role, once relief of whatever sort reaches the country involved, how much of a role do the people there take in deciding how it is used?
Well, we really try to ensure that the communities are involved actually in those decision-making processes. There are cultural issues to consider. These communities know who is the most vulnerable, who is the most affected, very, very individual level. And so when we're considering distributions, we talk with those communities, with the leaders. We help them, have them help us organize distributions. So it's not just something that you're chucking off the back of a truck, but that we work through those communities and make sure it's a very methodical process, so nobody is left out.
Mm-hmm. Now, how long does the period of urgent relief tend to last?
Well, it just depends on the situation. In this case, it'll probably be several weeks, at least that, until we can actually get all the way through the number of people that are actually going to need some pretty basic help. And as long as we don't have aftershocks or additional events that we're going to, again, you know, affect these people, we should be able to start rebuilding fairly soon and start the cleanup and rehabilitation aspects of the response.
Let's get another caller on the line. Larry's with us from Davis, California.
Good morning, and thank you for your show, and thank you for this conversation. I'd like to inquire if any of this aid now being planned, not necessarily delivered, but being planned, is any of this aid going to go toward prediction, toward analysis, toward a scientific way of warning people, including the establishment of a warning network within the Indian Ocean, much like it is within the Pacific Ocean. Is that on the agenda?
I'm certain that it is, particularly at the higher international and bilateral levels. In about 2 weeks' time, there's going to be a very large conference in Japan. It's called the World Conference on Disaster Reduction. And one of the issues, this conference has been planned for many years, but one of the main issues is looking at how we can reduce the risk. How can we reduce the number of people that were affected by disasters such as this? It's very, very critical that all of the governments around the world are involved, and this isn't just a relief response continually, but that we're looking at preparedness issues as well.
Thank you.
Thanks for the call, Larry. Let's talk with Frank. Frank's calling from Cleveland.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. My question is, how are there ways that we can personally help out by either going somewhere to help rebuild or help out in any way? Or at this point, is it just too soon to do anything personally?
Well, what we find is that sometimes when you're bringing people in from outside of the countries that maybe don't understand the situation, I know everything is very well intended of people wanting to really get hands-on, but there is quite a long learning curve, particularly the technical expertise that's required, the cultural sensitivities that go into assisting people. And so we still are really requesting people to look at other ways to donate, either through what we still prefer, which would be the cash donations, because it is the most flexible and the quickest way to assist. But, you know, there may be options further into the future during the rehabilitation stage where some organizations would be very interested in having volunteers helping them out, especially as this is a very, very long-term rebuilding that's going to be required here.
Okay. Well, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Are you sometimes, people of goodwill are rushing to help in this situation. Are you sometimes a little overwhelmed by them?
Yes. we've had so many wonderful ideas, and people really want to donate their time and the goods that they have. They want to rush over. But to be honest, we really are looking at a very structured. We can do a lot of damage if we're not careful about this. And it's one of the serious issues that all of the international organizations are looking at is when we go in with relief response, are we doing more harm than we're doing good? Are we leaving behind something that is damaging instead of encouraging and helping people out? So we're very, very careful on ensuring that we are working within their culture and within the requirements of that community and doing what they ask, not what we want to do.
Mm-hmm. And you're also dealing with a lot of different governments, just looking around the Indian Ocean area, from democracies in India to the military regime in Myanmar, the country formerly known as Burma. How do you get around uncooperative governments?
Well, there's a lot of advocacy then. If governments are not willing to open up access, then we really start using a lot of the state-level influences that we can access through organizations such as Interaction, who was on earlier, to go to the government and say, we are not getting free access for humanitarian aid with this government. You need to step in and put the pressure on. So we really work through a lot of channels in that regard.
We're talking about aid to tsunami victims. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And let's get another caller on the line. Charles is with us from Marietta, Ohio.
Yes, I just basically had a comment about the relief effort that was going on. I was in the Marine Corps in the early 90s when the tsunami went across the Bengali Islands and come ashore in Bangladesh. And we was put out on an island that provided clean water for over 70,000 people that was dislocated or displaced from the storm. So the amount of people that the U.S. is sending over there is going to be a tremendous asset to what is going on. And a real quick comment about working together with people. We worked hand in hand with the different nations that sent people over there, to include the Bengali Army, that helped provide an area that was safe for the U.S. people and the Australians.
I wonder if you think back on that time, Charles. It's a particularly proud moment, I would think.
Yes, sir, it was. Extremely proud. I was fortunate enough to be there for 45 days working in the area to help out with the relief effort, and the gratitude that we received was tremendous.
Charles, thanks very much for the call. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
Here's an email question from Jordan Wood in Minneapolis. The surge of charitable giving is likely to slow down over time. How could I give money to tsunami victims, which will be applied when there is less world attention to their plight?
Well, within most of these organizations, we do look at that longer term. There are some very, very immediate needs, but we know this is going to go on for years. So we are already planning for the longer term. And I would think, again, most of the major NGOs and charities that you're giving to have taken that into consideration. They know you can't spend the amount of money that has been given to date in a short period of time. There are some immediate needs, but the real costly and long-term efforts are going to be for 2 years, maybe 3 years, maybe even more. And they're going to plan appropriately to make sure we don't just throw everything into only responding with relief and don't think about what's going to happen in the future for these people.
Let's talk to Juan, and Juan is with us from Milton, Florida.
Good afternoon, sir. My question mainly dealt with the goods that are going to be provided to the people in need. Are these goods going to be purchased here in the United States and transported over, or is that something that's going to come out of the economy if they would
Juan's cell phone is causing a problem. Let me just tell listeners with headphones I could hear it. Are the materials that are being sent purchased in this country and sent over there, or is the money sent over there and they purchased over there?
Within the effort as a whole, there's a combination of those two. There's quite a few goods coming out of all of the countries around the world, the industrialized countries that are sending a lot of efforts directly, particularly through the militaries or large organizations. With respect to care, which I can answer to, we do prefer that we're doing this through cash. We are able to buy in country an awful lot of the goods that are necessary. We buy them faster, we buy them more efficiently, and we can transport them quickly, and we continue with an economic cycle, which is very, very important in these countries that have been, you know, devastated. And any little bit of support that they can get in-country is very important to them. So it's a combination of these two things.
And it's also a food that they may be familiar with.
Exactly. The things that are appropriate in their context. If you send jeans to a country that's very hot, it's not the best item to send in, and they prefer the traditional saris, and in the case of India and Sri Lanka, for example.
Gail Newdorf, thank you so much.
Well, thank you for having me.
Gail Newdorf is Deputy Director for Emergency Unit of CARE USA. She joined us by phone from her office in Atlanta, Georgia. When we come back from a short break, how Buddhist monks are dealing with the gruesome task of burying the dead. I'm Neil Conan. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News.